Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026, State Government Finance and Operations to order. Quorum is present, and we are going to go now through a series of independent motions to move minutes from previous meetings. Chair Cleburne, would you like to move the minutes from February 19th?
So moved.
Chair Cleburne has moved the minutes from February 19th. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We are going to skip the 24th. There was one small drafting error that we will correct, we believe. So, Chair Cleburne, would you like to move the minutes from February 26th?
So moved.
Chair Cleburne moves the minutes from February 26th. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Look at us. Okay, we have three bills on the calendar today, two of which are mine, so I'm going to walk towards the testifiers table, and at which point Representative Davis will take over, and we'll start that now.
Chair Nash, would you like to move House File 3676 before the committee?
I would like to bring it before the committee with a referral to transportation, Mr. Chair.
To your testimony, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill in front of us, 3676, is a bill that really started as a massive problem for a constituent of mine brought to my attention by my favorite banker in all of Waconia, which would be my wife. My wife was helping this person open up an account and do some account work, and the individual was having just a massive amount of trouble with things. The constituent, whose name I am not allowed to share with you, as for reasons that will become clear in a moment, was a battered woman who fled California, came to Waconia, assumed a different name, and then through a series of giant screw-ups, the departments here at the state of Minnesota exposed her newly assumed name with her previous name and ID, Social Security, and other. And it began creating a massive snowball of a problem. The individual was given my phone number. My wife has my permission to give it out to anybody who I can help. Called, and she was terrified of all the things that were in the process of happening to her. The abusive ex could have found her new location based on the information that got exposed through credit bureaus and through departments and counties and the state. And, you know, I've never gone through that. I don't know that any of us have, but for her to go through that had to be terrifying. So on the phone, I tried to help her as much as we could, and we worked with our House GOP constituent services, congressional constituent services, and our friends here at the Secretary of State. We successfully resolved her particular issues, but in the process, we found that there are things in the Safe at Home program that needs some tightening up. And so the bill that you see before you, 3676, is a way to do not just what we are trying to do for the tightening up for my constituent. There's something in there that I asked to have added, which is the ability for an emancipated minor to become enrolled in the Safe at Home program. For those that remember, I think there's just one member here that was not here last year. I grew up as an abused kid, and when I was 17 years old, if I had lived here in the state of Minnesota, I would not have been eligible to enroll in the Safe at Home program, even though, had it been offered to me, I think I would have taken it so that I could have disappeared off the radar so that my parents wouldn't bother me with their mess and the abuse that my dad was bringing forward. So I have testifiers who will speak to some of the other specifics, but this is a bill that was born out of a real-world problem here in the state of Minnesota, and we're solving it for my constituent and other people. And if you've never oriented yourself with a Safe at Home program, you really should. It's an amazing thing that we do to help people who are really in situations that are absolutely dire, disappear legally, and still operate within the world that we live in. So I have two testifiers, Mr. Chair, and I would like them now to be able to take over and guide you through what is in the bill, and we can all answer any questions afterwards.
To your testifiers, please state your name for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nicole Freeman. I'm the Government Relations Director at the Secretary of State's office. I'll do a really quick walkthrough, and then my colleague, Diana Umadon, who is the Director of Safe at Home, will just give a little more depth to the background that I provided. As Chair Nash mentioned, in Section 1, we are adding an emancipated minor to the definition of an applicant. We have worked really hard over the years to try to think of all of the scenarios and try to cover, you know, everyone from minor children, you know, all the way up to, anyone throughout their lifespan. And this was an oversight, and so we're excited to be able to capture this piece in here. The next definition that we're altering or that we're adding is a guardian acting on behalf of an eligible minor. And this clarification we feel like would be helpful both for staff but also for participants and guardians who are looking to apply on behalf of an eligible minor. We are looking to clarify that definition, that the guardian is a legal guardian who or a parent has their authority from a court order. And so because this is a program that if there is a safety need, whether they're with a guardian or with their parents, we want to make sure that everyone involved who has legal custody of that child is aware of it. The next definition that we're looking to add to, but will come out. We had an amendment ready, but because of the timing of engrossment, we weren't able to get that in for today. But lines 2.19 through 2.22 are going to come out. We are working with the Bankers Association to try to come up with a solution for participants using their safe at home address on business bank accounts. And I think we have discovered that we need to take a different route and talk with the federal government about that piece. So we are going to do that. Section 2 clarifies that a guardian that's applying on behalf of an eligible minor, that they need to provide a copy of the court order that is establishing their guardianship or legal custody. Right now, when we have a guardian applying on behalf of an eligible minor, we require this, but putting it in statute just makes it really clear so everyone knows what's required to be there. Section 3 is another section that is related to banks, and we're taking that section out in the next stop, but happy to answer any questions on that if they come up. Section 4 requires a judge to make explicit findings that the potential harm to the safety of a participant is outweighed by the interest in disclosure of a safe-at-home participant's physical address. Additionally, it requires that when a judge makes this finding, that they need to put it in writing, and that also they need to inform our office. Finally, it gives our office standing to request reconsideration of the disclosure, and I'll explain it in a little more normal terms in just a second. It allows for 30 days for our office to review and potentially intervene, and it also allows 30 days for the participant to prepare for having their physical address disclosed publicly. There are definitely situations where the participant's physical address is needing to be disclosed in court, you know, in court proceedings, and we fully recognize that. What this is asking the judge to do is consider the findings and the steps that are already in Chapter 5B, asking them to consider those and put those findings in writing, just as almost a triple check of making sure that the judge understands the gravity of disclosing a safe at home's physical address in public court records, right? So that is Section 4. Section 5, we're seeking to align the penalty for disclosure of safe-at-home participant data if that disclosure ends up causing significant bodily harm The penalty will rise from its current level to a felony, and that aligns it with the Judicial Protections Act, the Judicial Data Protections Act, making it a felony for disclosure if it leads to bodily harm. Section 6 prohibits discrimination of a participant based on their participation in the Safe at Home program. We do have some modified language that will be added in the next stop that adds an exception for, and I think further clarifies that it's based on, you know, has a reasonableness clause in there to further clarify that. Section 7 requires that Minnesota government offices, state agencies need to designate a safe at home point person. And I believe Diane is going to talk a little bit more about that, so I'll skip on there. Sections 8 and 9 allow for a participant, and this is why it needs to go to transportation next, allow a participant to use their safe at home card, which they're issued by our office, as proof of residence. So not proof of identity, but proof of residence when they're applying to get an ID, a driver's license, or a real ID in Minnesota. And then Section 9 adds a definition of what the safe at home card is. Section 10 requires that judges receive training on the Safe at Home program. Right now, we're hoping that, you know, training, we definitely have a lot of interactions with the court system, but hoping that the training of the judges will help them understand the gravity that disclosure of the participant's real address has.
And Mr. Chair and members, in the first stop of this particular bill, Chair Liebling actually had an amendment to remove that piece and on her own decision decided not to pull that out, and that we would work with the judiciary to not be overly prescriptive as to what training would look like, but that they would be effectively made aware of that. So apparently we can't tell judges what to do, but Chair Liebling said very clearly that it was her intent to leave it in because she saw value in at least making them aware of what this was, and that awareness could be construed as training. So that was of her choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Freeman, were you done with your testimony?
I was just going to say that sections 11 and 12 came out in our last committee stop. And so now that this bill has been engrossed, those two sections did come out. They related to requiring police officers to have some safe at home training. However, I understand there's a broader conversation about police and peace officer training that's happening. And so we'll come back in the future. We have a really great relationship with law enforcement and have done a number of trainings and continue to do them, but are just looking for, as the conversation moves on, to have some uniformity across the state so folks are aware. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole Freeman. To your next testifier, state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Diana Umadon. I'm the director for Safe at Home. And thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak today. I want to thank Representative Nash for his support for Safe at Home and for this bill. Currently, there are about 5,400 active Safe at Home participants in about 2,500 households in our state. Half of those participants are children. I'm here just to speak to two parts of the bill today. The first part is guardian. Nicole did explain that this, we want to define guardian because we do encounter some different type of child placements, and we want to define guardian for enrollment purposes only. Around the time of applying to Safe at Home and enrolling in Safe at Home, it is the highest, most often the highest safety risks for the people involved. And safety planning needs to be done. It's a very serious decision to enroll in Safe at Home. It's a volatile time. And it's always been our practice that if someone who is not the parent is enrolling someone in Safe at Home, that we do ask some questions. We require a proof of guardianship, a guardianship appointed by a court. So we're just clarifying what we've always been doing. Over the past year, we did encounter three different unique placement situations that, you know, made us have some internal discussion saying it's time we really do need to define what we're talking about when we say guardianship. So it's for initial enrollment only. If After that, if the child is placed with someone who is not the guardian or the parent, and there perhaps there's a delegation of parental authority, that's fine. We can work with them to help them transfer student records and things, but what we're talking about is initial enrollment only. The second part that I wanted to speak to was the part about requiring Minnesota government offices to designate a contact person for our office. We are not talking about creating a new position. We want someone who's already an employee. We're not asking for new work to be done or anything like that. There are things that come up periodically, questions from participants, unique situations. We do have some contacts in state offices, but sometimes we don't have the right contact, and it takes us weeks sometimes to get traction, to find the right person, to have that discussion. And so it's really in the best interest of participants if offices have a designated person, someone who's already an employee. Oftentimes it's their counsel, it's their, you know, it's your general counsel or an attorney or someone like that, but someone that we can reach out to and have a conversation with about the Safe at Home issue, or maybe they can point us in the right direction after that to help us resolve problems sooner rather than later. It is true that there have been times, and it can be really frustrating, where we reach out to someone and we don't get a response, we don't get traction, sometimes for 8 weeks. And so this would really speed things up for us and help us help other people sooner. And just the reason, I have a very brief list. We have very unusual situations that we have to deal with sometimes. And so I just kind of wanted to emphasize why we want all agencies, because we've worked with DEED, DHS, DNR on various issues. Just to give you a brief list of things that do come up. Well disclosures, radon testing, electronic visit verification, aquatic weeds, driveway permits, certificates of rent paid, electronic certificate of real estate value. All of these are things that we've had to collaborate with other state agencies to work out protocol or to resolve problems that have come up. So thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point that we just talked about, these, again, are people who are already acting in this role in most of the places that are being referred to. This would just articulate a person as the person that you reach out to via email or text or phone call. The work is already being done, and this is just going to speed it up because, honestly, if you're at this point where you're trying to enter the Safe at Home program, 8 weeks of delay just because somebody can't be said that, hey, this person over here is the contact, is 8 weeks too many.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will go to member discussion, and I have Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm curious about the federal compatibility and compliance, you know, things like the Real ID, for voting, if you're required on the HAVA, they ask for a real address, if that would be an issue. I do know there's a federal program of witness protection, but I'm not sure of similar compatibility. So how do we not violate the, some federal item? Is this compatible and compliant with federal? Just enlighten me.
Ms. Umadon,
yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Quam. The Representative Quam, the Real ID Act, when it was drafted many years ago, actually took into account address confidentiality programs, and it does speak to that. So we would be in compliant with a federal law with the if we did include the Safe at Home card as proof of residency. It's up to the state.
Thank you.
Yes.
Member discussion, any more? Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you very much, and I really do appreciate the bill, and I'm very supportive of the bill itself. I just want to make sure that I understand what is staying in and what is going out. So it is my understanding that lines 217 through 222 are being removed from the bill at the next stop. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And then I understand that lines 410 through 414 will be removed at the next stop.
Ms. Freeman.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Chair. Sorry. I just want to also, Chair, if I may, make sure that lines 517 through 525 is constitutional and we're not directing the court again to Chair Nash's statement that we can't tell the court what to do.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cleburne. Yes, so there are other already in this section. I just had it, 5B11. Yes, 5B11. There are already essentially instructions for the court as to, and it's not asking them or telling them how to make a finding or directing them in which way they should go, but it's giving them a framework of what they need to consider. And then just asking them to put those considerations in writing. And then also giving the, and I, we're, we have had contact with courts and have outreach to the district court judges as well. And I think we're flexible if folks have, you know, maybe there's a different timeline that makes more sense than the 30 days. But I think are just interested in making sure that the gravity of that disclosure is understood both by the court and that the participant has time to prepare for that. So it's not instructing them to side one way or another, but it's just asking them to put those writings, those findings in writing.
Okay. And
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, if I may continue. And then under section on line 5.30, where you are aligning the criminal penalty, we do not have the fiscal note in front of us for that public safety requirement for the felony. I would ask the chair to ensure that there is a fiscal note brought to this committee so that we can know how much that cost is, since it is my understanding the intent is to move the bill out and we haven't seen that fiscal note. Then moving on, Chair, if I may. Okay, then lines 6.6 to 6.13, that is the language that you plan to modify at a future date, is that correct?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cleburne. Yes, in this language, we're, like I said, adding, I don't know if the right word is comfort language, but it's a little more of an expansion that gets to proof of intent, like there's an intent to discriminate. And I'm happy to share that language with you as well.
Thank you. I would appreciate all of the modifications being shared with us. I'm sure we'll see it also in the engrossment. But then moving on to the real ID piece, are we anticipating any cost for that?
Nicole Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not aware of DPS's thinking in that. We know that they are already, so currently you can use your Safe at Home address on a driver's license, and so folks are already taking a Safe at Home card, making a photocopy, and that's used as verification that this person is a participant, so they can use the P.O. box on their, you know, as their address on their driver's license. And so that's a piece that I think we're waiting to hear from them what they,
we're heading to transportation.
Yeah, and we're heading to transportation next. I think this, the fiscal note is due in the next couple of days, if not sooner. So
thank you. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. And it's DVS, right? Driver Vehicle Services, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Under the department. Sorry. Under the public safety. Yes.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
And then thank you so much. And then with the last piece, with the direction for the in-service training, I would ask that that be moved to a request the court, even though I agree completely with the intent, right? Just so that this bill would be brought into constitutionality and not directing the court. I agree that the training is necessary and important and wholly am supportive of that, but I really want to make sure that our bills are constitutional and not tied up, because I think the work is really important and I don't want to tie it up in a court order debate. So,
and Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. And closing comments, Chair Nash?
Mr. Chair, Chair Cleburne, we can make sure that that gets done so that we offer it up as a heavy suggestion to the courts so as to not infringe on that. But I will say, members, thank you for the discussion. I think you've learned a little bit about just exactly how grave a situation this is, that if someone finds themselves in having to apply to enter this program, there's a lot of bad things going on in their life, and we want to make sure that we're trying to accommodate an easier entry into this and have it be stronger so that what happened to my constituent doesn't happen again, or to allow for an emancipated minor to have an easier on-ramp to getting into this, because again, if you found yourself in the situation that I did when I was 17, it would have been great to disappear, to be perfectly honest, and you all have been there with me along the way. This is something that we can do for the people of Minnesota who find themselves at the very last thread of their rope. And it's a good program. It's been in existence for a good long while. But when I met with the Secretary of State's office, they said, we're grateful that you're bringing this to our attention. We have a list of other things that we need to get done. And this bill is representative of work with the Secretary of State's staff. And I would encourage a yes vote. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion to send 3676 to transportation.
Chair Nash renews his motion to re-refer House File 3676 to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Passed. Thank you. Now, Chair Nash, you have another bill, House File 3683. Would you like to move that before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3683 and refer it to the General Register.
Now that your bill's before us, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, we talk a lot about fraud. It's been virtually a constant topic of conversation for a long time, and yet we have yet to quantify what that means to our forecast. And as you all remember, we just recently got the February forecast, and we talked about a lot of different things in there. There was a drop-in conversation that mentioned or referred to potential funds from the federal government not coming to the state of Minnesota, even though that action hadn't taken place yet. It was referred in there that this may be a mitigating factor. You know, for those that weren't with Chair Cleburne and I as we built the budget from last year, we got fairly granular in how we built this particular state government bill that we passed last year. We talked about a lot of things. We got all the way down to, I think at times, Chair Cleburne, tens of thousands of dollars that we were talking through. All of those dollars are included in the forecast that we get both in November and February, sometimes March. And I thought that it would be helpful as we move forward to include the potential impact cost-wise in our forecast as to the cost of fraud. So the good news is I had a roadmap on how to do this. This was drafted exactly to the model that was included, I believe, by now Leader Stevenson several biennia ago to forecast for inflation. So same language, removed inflation, inserted fraud, and put that in motion. And I will say, members, irrespective of what you think the number of fraud might be, we've heard from the former district attorney that it could be upwards of $9 billion. We've heard other people say, oh, no, that's too large. We're thinking more like a couple hundred million. Every single dollar that we deal with is rolled up into the forecasts. So it seems logical to me that we would similarly put in what the cost of fraud is into the forecasts. So as we look at what is the true cost of that money that has been effectively stolen from the citizens of the state of Minnesota, we can point to a document and said we are actually looking at this and accounting for it in our documents that we talk about the health and vitality fiscally of the state of Minnesota. So that is the gist of the bill, Mr. Chair, and I'm anxious for questions, I guess, or test. I think there
Chair
are
Nash, do you have testifiers? Do we have testifiers in the room? I believe we had Ms. Mingy.
While we're waiting, Chair, may I ask for a roll call on this vote?
A roll call has been requested. Thank you, Chair Clevorn.
Good morning.
Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Clevorn, members of the committee. I'm Anna Mingy, Deputy Commissioner with Minnesota Management and Budget. I want to begin by saying that any fraud of any kind is unacceptable, and as we've seen, there are criminals who are constantly looking for ways to take advantage of state systems. And the theft perpetrated by these criminals wrongly diverts taxpayer money away from those that are in most need, and it erodes trust in our public institutions. MMB is committed to working with you and with agencies across the enterprise to prevent, detect, and combat fraud, and to do all we can to ensure every tax dollar collected is put to use for the benefit of Minnesota's communities, residents, and businesses. We do want to express some concerns with the proposals the committee is discussing this morning related to the state budget and economic forecast and the operations of state agencies. With respect to House File 3683, I hope you all understand MMB works very hard to ensure that our forecasts communicate information that policymakers need to understand the state budget and the pressures that we are encountering. And while we appreciate the interest in creating additional tools to inform the legislature and the public on the topic of fraud prevention, our twice-a-year forecasts are not the place for this analysis. A forecast is a high-level, forward-looking budgeting tool based on projections of state revenues and spending. Identifying fraud is a much more rigorous analysis that is retrospective and involves many legal processes and definitions. The state budget forecast is updated with the most up-to-date information on expected spending in a state program, including program integrity efforts. For example, just last week, we highlighted the impact of the prepayment review process on updated state spending, which resulted in $238 million of forecast savings just to the general fund over a four-year period. That was the impact of a payment delay, cost avoidance, as well as additional denied claims. If MMB or another state agency knew of specific fraudulent activities that were increasing spending within a state program, we would work to stop those activities rather than continue to forecast that as ongoing state spending. The way that would appear in a forecast would be as a reduction in spending from a previous forecast, and that work routinely happens as a part of forecast preparation. We're also concerned by the language that instructs MMB to consult with legislative chairs on the impact of fraud in the forecast and to inform them of changes in the estimates of fraud from the previous forecast before it's released publicly. Although current law requires some pre-forecast consultation with legislative chairs and fiscal staff, that consultation has always been limited to forecast methodology and variables. And our reading of this language is that it's distinct and would result in the actual sharing of forecast expenditure data, which is a significant departure from current practice. Now, sharing a narrow set of data ahead of the forecast release risks politicizing the forecast and really fails to provide policymakers with the broader context, the total picture of the budget forecast. So thank you for the time, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Is there any member of the public who would like to testify? Chair Nash, would you like to follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate Ms. Mingy's commentary. I'll first say that I'm glad that we are finally talking about fraud and its impact monetarily. I think that it is it's seemingly impossible for me to wrap my brain around the fact that we can talk about fraud in the even the lowest amounts that some would like to offer up as only a few hundred million dollars. This impacts the health and vitality of our state. It does. And it is not necessarily a backward glance. It is impacting what can be put towards things moving forward. So to say that it's not actually having a play in the future outlook of our state, I believe is a misnomer. We'll be nice there. I think it is absolutely beyond the pale that we would not say that we should begin looking at how does fraud fiscally impact the health and vitality of our state moving forward. Because we, again, we just recently heard from DC that there may be a ceasing of money coming to the state of Minnesota, and that was immediately put in as a warning for the state forecast. I think that it's an incontrovertible fact that we've been dealing with fraud. I don't think anybody is now still saying, oh no, there's no fraud, because there is. And the impact of that monetarily must be considered. And anything short of that, in my opinion, Mr. Chair, is negligent, and we should be doing our level best to giving state government direction on how to properly assess the fiscal vitality of the state of Minnesota. And fraud not only has a retroactive cost, it has a long and ongoing cost, because it is also depriving programs of potential dollars that should have gone to the benefit of people who were supposed to be receiving them. That obviously went and was perverted into buying islands and jewelry and other things, as we've seen and established once again incontrovertibly. So the lack of that money being sent to people absolutely has a cost that must be accrued and forecasted as an impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Nash, and two-member discussion. We have Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Vice Chair Davis. I appreciate what you're doing here, or attempting to do here, Chair Nash. I know addressing fraud is something our side certainly takes very seriously, as yours does as well. You know, the bill is pretty short. It says probably the most relevant language is just the new subdivision 1K. It says the forecast must estimate the budgetary impacts of fraud committed against state programs. You know, in your remark just then, I know you mentioned the goal is to be both backwards looking and forward looking somewhat. I mean, I guess that kind of gets to my question. I'm just wondering, you know, the term fraud isn't exactly defined in the bill. Is the goal, or do you anticipate in incorporating fraud into the forecast, would that be fraud that we already know about, or is it potential fraud? I'm just wondering how it's calculated, kind of, and what
Chair Nash.
Aspect of fraud is looked at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Freiberg. I would say that once we begin articulating what that fraud is, as it has by the now former Attorney General for Minnesota, obviously they articulated different programs, different areas, and I will again mention that the mere hint of money not being sent to the state of Minnesota suddenly came onto the horizon in the forecast. So I think that once we begin looking at those, it should be considered before that next forecast. But certainly once articulated in a number, that has to go into this. So thank you.
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. I don't know if you want to comment further. I just, you said once articulated, it should be incorporated into the forecast. I'm just not exactly sure how you get that articulation. I mean, I'm, you know, just having this session, you know, this session and last session has been my first time as a chair of a committee with some budgetary impact. And I've always been impressed with MMB and just how the specificity with which they put together a forecast. So just to me, the ability to quantify fraud in this bill seems somewhat nebulous. I mean, if we're talking about known fraud that's already known about, then you might sort of just be asking MMB to be something of a news aggregator. If you're talking about, you know, fraud that's potential, I just don't really know, you know, I don't understand how that concretely can get incorporated into a number, just certainly not with the specificity that we're used to expecting from MMB. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And very briefly, so we can move on, I will also point out that in the November forecast, it was mentioned of what the potential impacts of tariffs may or may not be. And each time that they've come back and circled back as to the impact of tariffs, it has been less and less and less. So initially, MMB was fairly convincing that tariffs were going to be deleterious to the economy of the state of Minnesota, and each time they've lessened that number. So I think that in many ways, that was already a news aggregator. I think that that's in many ways answered your own question.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Chair Nash. I appreciate your desire to have more granular forecast, and you obviously are a numbers guy, and I 100% get that. In the last 2 months, we've also gone through an additional significant kind of personal and economic trauma in the state. And so I think in the interest of granularity, a question I have is whether or not it would also be necessary to include the effects of, for example, the federal law enforcement action, which resulted in driving students from schools, hampering their learning opportunities, drove people away from coming to work and businesses from even being able to open. Those are also going to cause downstream long-range impacts. Should those be also included in the forecast?
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Luger-Nicolai, I would say that if you would like to draft a bill, we could certainly have that conversation, but this is relative and directed expressly at fraud.
Representative Luger-Nicolai. Okay. We will go to Representative Bonner.
Thank you. First, again, I want to repeat that there is no disagreement in this room by anyone in this room that fraud is abhorrent. Unfortunately, fraudsters have been trying to defraud folks since the beginning of time, and it happens. And certainly for all of us in this room, and I will count myself in that, as legislators, we come here to make a difference, and we allocate money to people who are most vulnerable in our communities. Mm-hmm. And anytime a dollar does not go to those individuals who are most vulnerable, to women, to children, disabled folks, our veterans, that is extremely abhorrent. And so we just want to start with that level set. But my concern is here, I'm trying to think about, I'm a numbers person too. So I'm trying to think about how we calculate this and what we do. Now, and there's two parts that I was thinking about. First, if we talk about existing fraud and we use that as a measuring stick to try to potentially determine what we think will be the future. The challenge with that is in the interim, the legislature presumably is not abdicating its authority, and we are in fact making changes to improve process and change the way we do things to sort of stamp out that potential fraud. So I'm struggling with how we use existing, making changes to our programs to eliminate that fraud, and then using that as a measuring stick for what may or may not happen in the future. So there's that part. And then you have the future-looking piece, right? So I wonder, are we double counting? Because we're putting money in our budget for something, but we have no idea of knowing whether that dollar could be subject to a fraudster, or it might not be subject to a fraudster. So how do we create an equation or a formula to calculate what someone's behavior may or may not be? I'm really struggling with how we quantify that and how we look at that. And moreover, when we talk about the figures, and you mentioned the U.S. Attorney's figures, but I've seen multiple formulations of what something might be or might not be, and those figures sway wildly.
Chair Nash.
And so I just wanted, my question is this, Mr. Chair. So,
Bonner.
Thank you. With those wild fluctuations, and it doesn't seem that there's a clear definition of what that number actually is, how do we use these wildly suggestive numbers that are highly subjective to actually come to a formula that's fair to even consider this as part of a forecast that wouldn't then hobble our ability to determine what our future spending could or could not be and balance our future budget as it pertains to the people of Minnesota?
Chair Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner, I will say that once again, we modeled this after the inclusion of inflation in the forecast, and when that bill was created, it directed MMB to figure out how to include inflation, which again is a at times wildly debated number. Inflationary numbers are not always agreed upon by everybody, and yet MMB found a way to put that into the forecast. So I would say that the direction that we can give them is do similarly that with fraud, that which you did with inflation. And I will use your quote there that anytime money doesn't go towards a program is, I think you said crime, but I agree. And the opportunity cost or loss of that opportunity is something that we should actually begin accruing in our budget to say X billions of dollars were allocated, it didn't go there, and here is the fiscal impact of that on the state of Minnesota and its residents who have been robbed.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you. And so I just wanted to underscore this point. So we're talking about using the inflationary numbers as a forecaster of fraud. But inflationary factors have been studied over decades. And we have very important economists who study the fluctuations of economies of scale, who look at various factors within the economy to estimate things like inflation. We have a long, long history of data that they use to try and figure out what that would look like. I'm struggling, however, with comparing this to something we've studied for decades when we really don't have a good handle on what this looks like today, much less tomorrow or the future, and how we make that same comparison, because I feel like we're not comparing apples to apples here. And so just throwing out a wild number doesn't seem like the best fiscal responsibility.
Chair Nash, there was no question there. Would you like to comment? Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say, Representative Bonner, perhaps I misspoke because you didn't hear me because I'm under caffeinated. But I didn't say that we're going to use inflationary numbers. What I said was the direction was given to MMB to figure out how to forecast the impact of inflation, and that they were able to figure it out. And it was in that same vein that I said they can figure out how to begin forecasting the cost of fraud. So I wasn't saying we're going to bolt the two of them together. What I said is that in the same effort that they put forward to be able to forecast fraud, they too can be given direction to begin for forecasting inflation. They too can be given direction on how to forecast for fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Kosnick.
Thank you. And if Deputy Commissioner might be able to answer this question and come back. Appreciate the topic and discussing this. And it was good to see the prepayment withholding notated in the forecast and in the presentation so that we understand the attempts or the impact of doing that and being able to calculate that out. I think what the bill does is helps us forecast the impacts of potential fraud within our programs. And Deputy Commissioner, when we see the forecast presentations, there's always a lot of discussion about the state's bond rating. And didn't get to ask this yesterday in Ways and Means, but might be a little bit outside the scope of this bill, but could you talk about the structure, the impacts of the state bond rating having a structural deficit, but then more to the bill, what is the impact of the state's bond rating and reputation with the amount and level of fraud that we've been uncovering of $9 billion, possibly more when you add federal implications of fraud? What is the impact to the state bond rating with the massive level of fraud that we have?
Deputy Commissioner Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, so to the first question, we have, we meet regularly with all of the bond rating agencies several times a year, and we have been highlighting for them, as we have with the legislature and the public, the risks associated with an ongoing structural imbalance. Thanks to the significant work done by the legislature and the governor last session in significantly reducing the ongoing structural imbalance, we received positive feedback from the bond rating agencies, and we're able to maintain that AAA bond rating from all three credit rating agencies this year. I think governance is an important feature of bond rating, and it's something for which Minnesota scores consistently well. I think what is important to bond rating agencies is understanding how our, you know, whether or not Minnesota is able to fill on our long-term obligations. And I don't know that we haven't had specific conversations about fraud.
Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. I appreciate giving us some insight on the state's bond rating with regard to fraud. I'm a little surprised that to hear that the bond rating agencies aren't that concerned and think that they were a pretty well-governed state. I'm not sure that's the reputation that I would inspect as I go across the country and talk to other legislators about this. So I appreciate what the bill does. Representative Nash, Ms. Mingy, in the letter that's in our packet here from MMB, and some of the discussing the fraud and maybe some new initiatives on the last page, it says to establish permanent bans on state contracts and grants for individuals convicted of fraud. Is that a new proposal that MMB is suggesting? If I could just ask that real quick.
Deputy Commissioner.
Yes, if you're the Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, to the extent you're looking at the sort of the list on the third page of the letter from Commissioner Campbell, those are provisions of the administration's anti-fraud package. And more specifics will be coming out sort of in the next few weeks.
Chair Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that's a provision I would support. What I'm dumbfounded about is that for the last 7 years of this administration and administrations before that we don't, that we actually need to establish a new policy to permanently ban from state contracts and grants individuals convicted of fraud. That should have been going on a long time ago. Chair Nash, because we have not done things as simple as that, thank you for bringing this forward, and I think it should be notated as we look at the state forecast and what our budgeting is, the amount have fraud notated in our forecast, so as the legislature, we can take a closer look at our budgets and say, hey, wait a minute. Maybe this program is a little bit more susceptible to fraud, and we should tap the brakes on continuing to funnel taxpayer dollars into programs that are high risk. So I look forward to having some policy that bans people that are convicted of fraud from continuing to get contracts, but I think it would be extremely helpful to go into a budget process eyes wide open with the forecast that says we have fraud in our programs, might not be the specific dollar amount, that's not exactly, you know, forecast are never exactly down to the penny, but it gives us an idea of how we're spending our money and what the forecast down the road might be, and knowing that a program might be highly susceptible to fraud would be helpful to legislators and respectful to the taxpayers of Minnesota that, hey, we're aware of this and maybe we should do something different. So thank you for the bill. Thank you for the answers, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. Chair Kwom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to members that are wondering how can we get information, there's correlations to the lack of enforcement and monitoring that have shown in audits. You have the independent group that went and says there's concerns with, 80-90% on a program. The other thing you can correlate to is the federal dollars being spent in the program come with the catch that there is a requirement for additional and more stringent auditing and looking at the use of the dollars. And there have been occasions of where the state has had to refund to the federal government money because they did not appropriately spend or account for the funds. So if I look back, say 8-10 years, there were a much smaller level of missed things like site visits and other documentation. That has been accelerating in the last few years. And so if we look at the history of the fraud, we correlate that to the adherence to standard practices, you'd be able to come up with a reasonable estimation plus or minus an amount because there's data there. And any program that has federal dollars spent on it is supposed to have some additional auditing. That hasn't probably been quite as consistent since we let the legislative auditor not be doing all of those, and some outside entities have been involved, and we can look at improving that. But to say that there isn't any basis for doing calculations or estimating a range is naive and incorrect. So maybe because I've been on the Legislative Audit Commission, have seen these audits and have seen the trending from previous audits to recent audits about adherence to standards, I think we can come up with a good ballpark. And of course, that accuracy is going to improve after we initiate, you know, this process. But I have confidence in the competency of the entities being involved in this analysis to at least come up with a reference number and feedback to the legislature. What is wrong with having that additional comment and a projection? But we, offline, I can speak to any of you about the Legislative Audit Commission reports and the examples thereof. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Nash. So I've been struggling to understand this bill a bit. In terms of quantifying what's already happened, we should do that, absolutely. And in terms of is it adding value to the forecast number if we were to do this? I can't see how it is, because if there is fraud in a government program or decreasing fraud, then that should be reflected in those, in how those numbers are being forecast. So it doesn't add value there. Then if you're saying, okay, we're going to create a forecast of what fraud is going to be, well, we've all said, and yeah, any level of fraud is unacceptable, right? So what is, you know, the moment you put out a number says, okay, we're gonna say this amount of fraud is going to be happening, right? There's incredible bias possible for, like, how can any administration, how are we going to accept that anyone is saying, okay, we're going to have an acceptable level of fraud in our forecast?
Chair Nash.
So there's going to be, I'm not done. So it's going to create this tremendous opportunity just for us to yell at each other. So I just don't understand what the benefit is of doing this. And you talk about inflation, forecasting inflation. Well, inflation is a number that's tracked by many third-party groups. Certainly it's hard to figure out how we're going to incorporate it, but an inflation number and a forecast of inflation, those are things that are clearly tracked by unbiased third parties. So, like, I know fraud is good. We should be knowing how much has happened. We should be rooting it out. But I don't understand how this is anything more than a opportunity to yell at each other a bit and for really little value in terms of actually rooting out fraud.
Chair Nash, if you remember the question.
Mr. Chair, well, Representative Kraft, I'll say you use the word value quite a bit there, and you said that this is effectively an opportunity to yell at each other. I would say that if you talk to a citizen of the state of Minnesota, they're yelling right now about being defrauded of billions of dollars. So finding a way to mathematically project the impact of that is what we're trying to do here. And I'm mystified as to how we're trying to wiggle away from saying that there is an impact. You said quantifying what's happened isn't adding value. Those were your words because I wrote them down. And I'll finish and then we can get back to you. But the value is in letting Minnesotans know how much they've been screwed over by fraudsters. And why are we trying to get away from that? We should say, you know what? Bad people did things, and I don't believe that anybody is saying that it doesn't have a fiscal impact. So by the very virtue that it has a fiscal impact, why are we not placing it into the forecast?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is not what I said. Quantifying the impact is absolutely important, and we should absolutely do that and root it out. What I'm saying is trying to forecast an acceptable level of or a fraud that is going to be in our systems in the future when we are going to – the aim is to root it out. I'm saying there I don't see how that is creating anything but an opportunity for I just don't see the added value in that process. We absolutely, and I was clear about this, finding a level, what fraud has happened, absolutely.
Chair Nash, would you like to respond?
We'll just move on to the next question.
Okay, Vice Chair Bonner, did you have one more question? If it could be briefly, please.
Thank you. I mean, I have many, but I will just try to list, in the interest of time, a couple. I mean, first, I'm very curious from Ms. Mingy about whether or not we typically talk about fraud in determining bond ratings. I'm assuming we don't do that, but we can certainly talk about that offline. And then we talked, I'd certainly, and maybe again, this is for Ms. Mingy, but talking about whether other states use things like this to determine their budgets, because I have never heard of a legislature ever using this as a determiner of their future budgets. And I would be interested in why or why they do not include it, because I suspect there are pretty gosh darn good reasons. But then I'll just make this comment and not make it a question in the interest of time. But, you know, I think the other real struggle with this is we do have third-party verification systems for things like figuring out inflation. We have decades of research and study. What we're trying to do here is create a formula based on wild projections that we don't know what they are with very little data to really understand what this is. And then we're going to come up with a random formula to do this. But the other part about this is that what nobody in this room has said yet is that the amount of fraud that we have in our programs is very likely tied directly to the decisions we make at this table. And what does that mean? And please, if the audience would be quiet. I will say this. So when we make decisions about a program that we put out there, we put in place specific guardrails in determining who gets that money, who's eligible for that money, what hoops they have to jump through to get that money. And we make choices, and we balance those choices against each other. If our intent is to make sure that people are in a time of great need, we sometimes loosen those controls to make sure people get those dollars in a timely fashion. We did that during the pandemic. And some of what we're talking about here did happen during the pandemic. We loosened those controls because the need was so great. The situations for people were dire. So we loosened those controls. Now we've swung back the other direction post pandemic, and we have retightened those controls. But every time we tighten those controls, what we also do is we make it really hard for the people who really, really need the aid to get it. So it's always up to us as legislators to determine, do we really want to get the aid to the people who need it, the most vulnerable? Or do we want to loosen those or do we want to tighten it down so hard that those folks who need it can't get it? And that is really the point here. And I find this sort of exercise that nobody wants to acknowledge that everyone at this table has a role in that particular equation, and how we then take that and turn it into a formula on whether or not we tighten the controls or don't tighten the controls, whether we make it impossible for somebody to get aid versus not get aid, and they just suffer is really a struggle for me. And I would hope that we can get at a later date, since we apparently do not have time, to get more answers from Ms. Mingy, for example, on what other states are doing, why they are or not putting this in the forecast, why they are or are not putting these inflation or these factors into determining things like bond ratings, because I don't know of anybody who does that.
To your question, Rep. Bonner.
That is the point. I will let it go, but I just feel like this bill needs significant work. I certainly appreciate the idea of getting our hands around how much fraud there is and how we address those issues, and specifically the policies that we put in place in this committee, in this body, to prevent fraud, not to forecast it.
Chair Nash.
I'll save for conclusion. I believe Chair Cleburne may have something to say, and then we can go from there.
Representative Joy.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this administration has ignored procedures and falsified documents. That's what we've seen. This here, I think we could put this in here, because us legislators sitting here arguing over this, we're going to be at zero. That's our goal. We shouldn't have to worry about what we're going to forecast. They should be able to write this as zero. We're sitting here arguing whether we should put this number in here or not, to be transparency to people, to tell them what the effects are. We want to sit here and shadow and say, oh, this isn't, you know, this is going to cost so much work. We got third parties. This whole group sitting here should be happy to know that we're going to move forward and not have fraud. There's going to be some. There's going to be checks and balances. But we just talked about how we loosened the strings over COVID, and then we tightened them back up. Sure did. $9 billion later, looks like we really tightened it up. I think this is a great bill, Representative Nash, and I look forward to voting yes on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joy. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much, and I always love state government. We have a robust conversation on everything, so it's awesome. Chair Nash, I appreciate what you're trying to do. I just want to say that. But if you will look at lines 2.5 to 2.11,
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. When I see these lines, it's a very simplistic view of what would happen. Could you just kind of walk me through the timeline and exactly how you see this working?
Chair Cleburne, could you repeat that? What lines again? I'm sorry.
2.5 to 2.11.
Chair Nash.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Cleburne, I'll make you this offer. We can have Mr. Sullivan remove that right now, if that's your sticking point on voting yes, and we can go straight to a vote with that being an on-the-fly amendment that we remove from the bill.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand how the process works. How do you see this forecasting happening? So I think of it like this. You have guests coming to a wedding, and you have to plan for them, in a process, I'm talking about a process, from the time they get off the plane until the wedding is over, what are they doing? There are steps. They get off the plane, they check into their hotel, they come to the reception, right? We walk them through step by step by step how this would look. You're talking about forecasting fraud, and you're saying that they must consult with the minority and leads of the finance committees, the representative of ways and means, right? And taxes, I believe. Okay, so oftentimes when we see problems in programs, it's not those chairs that see it first. It's the chairs of the other committees that might see the indicator first. So I'm trying to figure out the process that you have in mind for this forecast to happen. So it's not the exact language, but what is the process?
Sure, Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Cleburne, we can certainly add other chairs if you'd like to expand the list. And I would say that the process would be to consult with them, saying, hey, what are some things that you see on the horizon? What are things that you see happening? Give them the information. And once again, this is modeled on a bill that is now law that your leader, Stevenson, brought to begin forecasting inflation. Very similarly constructed. And I would say that we'd be more than happy to add every chair, if that would make you happy, or I'd be willing to take this out and put it into the lap of MMB to say, you figured it out before, here's your opportunity to do it again.
Chair Cleburne, would you like to offer an oral amendment?
No, I would not like to offer an oral amendment. What I'm trying to show the committee, thank you, is that this bill doesn't really do anything, right? It appears that it is a plan to do something, but it doesn't really lay out a plan. Mm. And so I would like, and I would be happy to work with you if you have a legitimate plan to address a way to do this. Okay, great. But to go in and say that a conversation with what might be happening or what might not be happening 2 weeks prior to a budget forecast without data, I mean, I want to know, what is the formula? What's the data? How do we do it? And I think my side of the aisle has said this over and over. When we deal with inflation, we talk about it. There's statistical data behind it. I don't know where that comes from. So I would like to see a real concrete process with timelines and it laid out in order to be able to support a bill that would do this. And I don't see that in this bill. Now, to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, I would like to say, next Thursday, you will have an opportunity to vote on permanent withholding when fraud is suspected, and it does require other agencies to say if they do or do not see fraud, and if so, those individuals would be banned. So I'm really excited to hear that there's support for my bill on Thursday. The other thing I would like to just kind of level set, I really want to level set this. I have heard outrage for fraud, and 100% we should all be outraged. No dollar should go where it is not intended to do. I agree 100%. I think if we had to vote on that on a roll call, we would all vote yes on that. But I want to remind this body, this committee, on the fraud prevention measures that we passed in 2023 and 2024 that did not receive votes from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle and were not passed off the floor by my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, but our side, the DFLers, passed. We passed extensive grant management requirements. We created the Office of Grants Management. We did pre-award risk assessments, which we have seen have saved money. We have detailed, more detailed agreements are required. Mandatory reporting is required, progress reports are required, and we invested in oversight in all of our agencies. I would just like to remind you that the state government Republicans voted against every one of those things in 23 and 24. The very things that prevent fraud are voted against, and the very things that politicize fraud are voted for. Thank you. Members, I'm going to ask for a no vote.
Chair Nash, I would just like to, before I let you close with your comments, I would just like to thank you for this bill, and I would just like to ask a question. Do you have you passed legislation before that was questioned that has actually helped administrations do their job when it comes to fraud?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You stole some of my closing thunder. It was in this very committee last year where I was told that my House File 3 was a bill that did nothing. And yet, if you talk to, as I did in my office with MMB, they actually came back and said, this actually is very helpful. It turned out from a bill that did nothing to a bill that became bipartisan. So apparently sometimes bills that do nothing, folks change their mind about that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will close because we have Representative Niska on deck here. But to Representative Bonner, I will say that you said that other states aren't doing this. Other states aren't looking at the amount and level of fraud that we have in the billions of dollars. And that, members, is not the type of Minnesota exceptionalism that I think that we all wake up thinking, ooh, I want to represent that in the legislature. That's not what we're doing. And I will close with this. You know, I had an opportunity a while ago to be in a parade where the Budweiser Clydesdales were in there, and they were pulling their wagon. And I think the comparison that I would make is that the Budweiser Clydesdales were encumbered with blinders, and I would encourage you not to be. I know that Chair Cleburne has requested a roll call, so I will renew my motion that House File 3683 be referred to the General Register, and I believe a roll call was requested.
Chair Nash, you renew your motion that House File 3683 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. I will have the CA take the roll.
Chair Nash.
Nash votes aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy.
No.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Jones excused. Representative Joy.
Thank you, yes.
Representative Kosnick.
Aye.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Sexton.
Yes. There being seven yeses and six noes, the motion does not prevail, and House File 3683 is laid over. Chair Niska, you have House File 3395. I will move your bill before the committee, and if you could proceed and talk about your bill. And I'm sorry, this is being referred to public safety, correct?
If you say so.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Chair Niska. Go ahead, proceed.
Thank you, Chair Davis, Co-Chair Cleburne, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3395, the Fraud Isn't Free Act. For years, members of our caucus have sounded the alarm on the systemic rot in the culture of accountability within our state agencies, and for years we've been told that we were playing politics. But last week, the Walz administration's own Director of Program Integrity, Tim O'Malley, released a report that finally acknowledged the truth. The roadmap to program integrity finally admits what Republicans have been saying all along. This administration has presided over a, quote, compassion over compliance culture that effectively left the vault door wide open. We're told that processes are the problem, but processes don't backdate documents. Processes don't key cars. People do. And House File 3395 is about accountability for those people. People like a, quote, financial compliance lead at DHS, whose literal job was to ensure that rules are followed. Yet while on the taxpayer clock, he was caught on video in a vandalism spree against private citizens. In any organization with even a modicum of accountability, he would have been gone in an hour. But in this administration's 30% compliance culture, he remained on the payroll for months while he was under review. House File 3395 is about people like the behavioral health fabricators. Just 2 months ago, the legislative auditor revealed that multiple DHS employees, not just one or two bad apples, but a systemic group, backdated and fabricated documents to cover up their failure to oversee millions in grants. They didn't just fail, they actively misled auditors to hide their tracks. And House File 3395 is about accountability for people like Mr. Grumdahl, who for years oversaw the Housing Stabilization Services Program as Assistant Commissioner. Under his watch, that program exploded from a $2.5 million estimate, a forecast, to a $100 million a year magnet for fraud. He is, as far as we can tell, the only person that this administration has ever fired for fraud, and it just happened to be one day before he was supposed to testify before the House Fraud and Oversight Committee. Director O'Malley's report admits that the state has been on notice about these vulnerabilities since 1977. That's 50 years of learning lessons while the checkbook stays open. House File 3395 aims to end that unpaid-for failure. It does so by doing a few things. First, it requires salary cuts for failures. If a significant loss for funds happens under an agency's watch, the commissioner has to take an immediate 25% pay cut. If the tone at the top
is the problem, as Director O'Malley says, then accountability needs to start at the top. It also requires budgetary discipline. We mandate a 10% administrative budget cut for agencies that fail to protect public funds. We have to stop rewarding incompetence with more oversight funding that bureaucrats use to hire more people, like the individual we referenced earlier, keying cars while he's on the clock. And House File 3395 requires a 5-year ban. If an employee is found grossly negligent or involved in the backdating of documents to hide fraud, they should be banned from state employment for 5 years. We must end the practice of letting failed leaders resign only to show up in a different department a few months later. Director O'Malley's report is a long overdue admission that the Walz administration's 70% compassion, 30% compliance model has failed the people of Minnesota. And as Representative Bonner just said, the fraud is a result of decisions that we make here in the legislature. We need to make different decisions here in the legislature. Compassion for the needy is a virtue, but compassion for fraudsters, for car vandals on the clock, and for managers who fabricate documents is a betrayal of every taxpayer in our state. Fraud isn't free. It's time for the people in charge to start paying for it. That's what House File 3395 does, and I urge members to support it.
Thank you, Leader Niska, and I understand we have an author's amendment, the A2. I will move that before the committee. Can you tell us about the A2?
The A2 does two things. It corrects a technical cross-reference error, and it adds a 25% threshold to the benchmark of fraud that must be recouped. Again, trying to set a reasonable performance indicator for an agency that has seen fraud under its watch.
Any questions to the amendment? Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. And members on our side of the aisle, I would recommend a yes vote on the amendment to allow the author to have the bill in the form that the author would like the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Carried. Member discussion to the bill as amended. Oh, we have a, is there a Devin Bruce who would like to testify? Come on up here, Mr. Bruce. Bruce, state your name for the record and who you're with and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, MAPE. We represent about 18,000 state professionals across all agencies, boards, and commissions. Apologies for my voice. I'm just getting over a cold, so I will try and grin and bear. Typically, we don't testify on what's clearly a messaging bill, but I had to make an exception given that the provisions in this bill, specifically Section 2, Subdivision 5, as well as Section 3, Subdivision 1, continue to perpetuate a false narrative that if fraud occurs, state employees are to blame, and I had to just make an exception to my normal rule. Not only does the process outlined in Section 2, Subdivision 5, violate employees' due process rights to a fair investigation that is protected in our collective bargaining agreements, it is unnecessarily duplicative of what is already required or permitted under state law. And it would also not only result in what appears to be the intention of the author, which is to address the lack of accountability for our agency leaderships who perpetuate these issues, as the O'Malley report identifies as perpetuating a culture of compassion over compliance, but it would unnecessarily fall on the wrong people. These prescriptive penalties will ultimately disproportionately fall on the rank-and-file staff instead of the commissioners or division directors that ultimately are responsible for the things that are highlighted in the report. Similarly, the clawback or the withholding outlined in Section 3, Subdivision 1, would also fall disproportionately on the very employees you would be relying upon to rectify the issues of noncompliance, not the top. While we understand that this proposal is highlighted to address just one aspect of the ongoing fraud issues for agencies. It also fails to recognize that the systemic issues that allow fraud to occur in the first place, particularly on the privatization and third-party contracting, as well as the chronic underfunding of state resources or staffing, as well as the outsourcing, particularly of the programs and its oversight. The more that the state continues to outsource and privatize state services and programs, the less control that we are able to exercise over it, as well as its oversight, as has been highlighted time and again in both the OLA reports and before this committee. So going forward, we hope that more time is also spent talking about these inefficiencies, highlighting some of the proposals that are coming from both the GOP as well as the DFL side that emphasize prevention and establishes guardrails that the committee has spent a lot of time on accountability and also remedies. And as the idiom goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and we ask that you move those forward as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. I believe we have another testifier on deck. Deputy Commissioner Mingy. And I know you've already introduced yourself, but if you would please remind us who you are.
Thank you, Chair Nash. I'm Anna Mingy, Deputy Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. As I mentioned earlier, MMB is committed to working with you and with agencies across the enterprise to fight fraud. We want to speak to some specific provisions in the bill before you. So we appreciate the provision in the bill to repeal the sunset on the new payment withholding authority for state agencies that was enacted in the 2025 legislative session. MMB actually has a proposal to strengthen and make this authority permanent and look forward to the discussion of this at Thursday's hearings, Co-Chair Cleburne's bill. We do have serious concerns, however, that House File 3395 would deprive state agencies of the tools and the resources to take on criminals attempting to defraud state programs. The bill requires significant cuts and disruptions to programs, even in situations when fraud is initially suspected but not ultimately substantiated, or in situations where neither the agency nor its payee was responsible for a fraud incident and the agency's preventative controls caught the attempt. Agency central offices often house the functions and tools that support fraud prevention and compliance. And even a small number of fraud reports would severely hamper an agency's response capacity following successive 10% budget reductions, which could take months or longer to be restored. So for agencies with large programs, they could have 10 reports of fraud in a relatively short period of time, which would essentially eliminate their central office budget. We also worry that eligible beneficiaries of state programs might be harmed during lengthy enrollment suspensions that the bill would require. The bill requires that enrollment in programs be suspended upon report of a fraud, and in large programs, that could represent month or years long enrollment suspensions in major state programs. Moving to the employee discipline provisions of the bill, while we agree that allegations of misconduct or inadequate job performance should be taken seriously, these changes seem to undermine employee due process rights and contemplate discharging employees without an independent and impartial investigation. Finally, as I noted in the previous bill, we appreciate the interest in creating additional tools to inform the legislature on the topic of fraud prevention, but our twice-yearly forecasts are not the place for that analysis. So the administration, as you know, is bringing forward a package of proposals noted in more detail in the letter from Commissioner Campbell, and we hope they will be considered by the legislature over the course of this session. So thank you for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Mingy. We will move to member questions. I don't have anybody on the list. Representative Luger-Nicolai, go ahead. We are going to get to a vote. We have 17 minutes left, so please be brief. You may want to turn your microphone on.
Yes, I am very sorry. That's rookie stuff. So, Representative Niska, thanks for bringing this forward. I share Mr. Bruce's concerns about the language that he identified on page 3 and also on page 2. A question I have with respect specifically to subdivision 5 on lines 3.1 to 3.10 is, who makes a determination that fraud occurred? What's the actionable determination?
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Nash, and thank you, Representative Luger-Nicolai. Good to see you. The agency head has directed that under certain circumstances, under certain finding, that they need to discharge the employee. So it doesn't provide for any other mechanism other than a direction to the agency head to do that.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Nash. So now, on lines 2.15 to 2.17, the mere act of returning an investigative report to the Legislative Audit Commission triggers the actions set forth in Subdivision 5. Isn't that correct?
Representative Niska.
It triggers the applicability of Subdivision 5.
Yes, it says they
Representative
must.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Yes, it says they must take the actions required under lines or subdivision 3 to 5, which includes the firing of people.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Nash. And it requires the firing of a person, quote, whose intentional or negligent act or failure to act abetted the fraud or allowed it to occur. So that would require a determination by the head of the agency that a person has committed some intentional or negligent act or failure to act abetted the fraud or allowed it to occur. If I think we would all agree that anyone who is employed by the state who is doing intentionally or negligently allowing fraud to occur should be fired.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
Well, Chair Nash and Representative Niska, you know, my day job, I work a lot of times with people where there's a dispute about fact, about both whether something happened and what the nature of the penalty ought to be. That's kind of my whole brand. And so my question is, under what circumstances can this decision-making be challenged? Is it through a grievance process? Is there what would be the cause of action in a court if an individual
Niska.
Disagreed?
Thank you, Chair Nash and Representative Luger-Nicolai. This doesn't change the overlay of any applicable processes that would be in place for anyone who is fired for cause as a state employee. Oh.
Representative, any further questions?
Quick question, which is the agency head retains the ability to make the ultimate determination. That's, as I understand it, your understanding of this bill. What if they are the individual who is under investigation or the subject of the report returned by law enforcement that is all by itself a trigger for action?
Representative Niska.
Then the governor probably should fire him, which hasn't happened, unfortunately.
Sorry, Chair Nash,
Representative Luger-Nicolai, last question, if you might.
Yes.
Thank you.
What is, okay, but they have a series of responsibilities themselves if they believe somebody else is also part of this issue, because negligence is one of your triggers, not just intentional fraud. And so if they think somebody was negligent because they forgot to read an email or they didn't pick up a voicemail and that was somehow characterized as an important omission, they are in the hot seat and they also retain the ability to fire subordinates. Is that correct?
Representative Niska.
If the governor chooses to leave people in place who the governor should fire, I think that's something that we should all be concerned about what's happened over the last several years. But yes, absolutely. I think commissioners, the point of this bill is to create another mechanism for commissioners to be held accountable, which unfortunately we have not seen happen as billions of dollars have flowed out of our state coffers. Those of us who have come from the private sector know any functional private sector organization would have had hundreds of people fired in a billion-dollar scandal, including probably the CEO of that organization. And that accountability has not happened, and that's why House File 3395 hasn't occurred. If you think there are other changes that need to be made to the due process overlay of our state employees to make sure that some state employees could be fired who haven't been fired for reasons that I think we would all agree that state employees should be fired for, then I'm open to adding additional things in here to change other parts of the law. This doesn't do that. It just says to a department heads, this is cause to fire somebody if their active or negligent acts led to the state being defrauded. That is cause to be fired. I hope we can all agree on that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could the first testifier make his way back up to the table?
Mr. Bruce, you can come back up.
Hopefully his voice will hold out. When I'm at home and visiting with folks, I think fraud is the number one topic that's brought up. And one question that we always hear is, has anybody been fired? and especially for things like backdating documents, things like that. To your knowledge, how many, if any, state employees have been fired over these fraud issues over the past couple of years? Any numbers on that?
Mr. Bruce. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I don't have that. I wouldn't know that. I'm on the legislative side. That was a business rep side.
Representative Anderson.
I wouldn't have that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, who would have that, and how could that be made available to the committee?
Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. That would be probably MMB.
Representative Anderson, would you like to ask MMB to come forward?
Yes, please.
Ms. Mingy, if you would come forward. Or phone a friend. And if the friend would introduce themselves for the record, we can proceed. Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed to answer the question.
Good morning, Chair, members. Blake Chafee, Deputy Commissioner, other Deputy Commissioner, Enterprise Employee Resources at Minnesota Management and Budget. My sincere apologies, Chair, Representative. Could I get the question again from you?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Wondering, because we get asked this a lot, how many, if any, employees have been let go, been fired because of their lack of duties, especially concerning backdating documents, things like that?
Mr. Chafee.
Chair, Representative, good question. I think first and foremost, MMB does not maintain discipline data for the enterprise. So that is not information that I have right now. Disciplinary data, including discharge for cause, is something that's maintained individually by agencies, by appointing authority. Discipline up to and including discharge is issued following a finding of fact, right, related to specific employee conduct that's found to be in violation of statewide policy, agency-specific policy. So in the event that there's an allegation of employee performance or misconduct that, for instance, as per the conversation today, that's led to fraud being perpetrated, a formal investigation would follow, and if substantiated, the employee would be disciplined as appropriate, up to and including discharge. But to the primary question, that is not data that MMB maintains.
Representative Anderson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, just wondering if it's available anyplace, and to what Representative Nisko mentioned, certainly in private business, I think that would happen.
Sure.
Not so sure it's happened here at the state, and if those numbers are available, there's a lot of people wondering what's happening and why people have not been let go for not doing their duties and allowing things to happen that certainly shouldn't be happening with state tax dollars.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nisko, for this bill. This, again, transparency. This is accountability. This is exactly what Representative Paul Anderson was just saying about, in my district, same thing. Has anybody been arrested? Has anything happened? You know, we just heard earlier in a bill that we talk about how they took fraud actions and tried to prevent these things from happening, and the Republicans refused, and the Democrats passed it and did all those great bills. We had OIG bill we're trying to get through, and the Democrats want to gut that. That bill passed in the Senate 60-7. Seven Democrats said no to it. If we're serious about taking on fraud, then their members over there that carried that bill, you think would move that bill forward without having to gut that bill and change it so that Governor Waltz is in control. The CEO should not be in control no more. We have an issue here. This is accountability. This is exactly what Minnesota is looking for, holding people. And you know what? If they are afraid of getting fired, they'll quit doing what they're doing. You've got to hold people accountable. Private sector does this all the time. When we have a bookkeeper stealing from us, we don't let the bookkeeper hire the auditor. That doesn't happen. This is just so easy. But all we get on the other side is constant fighting against, you guys are trying to shadow fraud. You're trying, and we did this. No, you didn't. Let's move forward and get this done so fraud is stopped this year. Thank you, Ms. Representative Nisko, for this bill.
Okay. We will go to Chair Clyburn, and then we're going to concluding thoughts from the author, and then to a vote. Chair Clyburn.
Thank you, and I'll just make sure we have a roll call vote.
Roll call having been requested. Roll call will be granted.
Thank you very much. Representative Nisko, Section 3, where you unallot 10% of the agency's budget, is that correct? It's 10%?
Representative Niska.
That is correct, on a certain trigger, correct.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. Could you please tell me how many Minnesotans would be impacted by the loss of services if an unallotment is created by 10% of any agency?
Representative Niska.
Well, the savings in fraud that we will get if we have agencies preventing fraud instead of allowing billions of dollars to go out the door, I think, would be the biggest impact of this bill.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. So you don't have a number, is that correct?
Representative Niska.
This is assuming some sort of future fraud happening after passage of the bill. I hope we would not have to assume that would be happening after the bill.
Chair Cleburne.
You know the old statement about assumptions. Is there anything in this bill that actually outlines a preventative measure for fraud?
Representative Niska.
Certainly. So there's a requirement that the agency create a corrective action plan and meet the benchmarks in that corrective action plan. And frankly, I would think that we as a legislature would expect agencies, even without a finding of fraud, to actually be performing, to be hitting performance benchmarks in order to get the money that we're taking from Minnesota taxpayers and giving to agencies. And so when there is a reason why that corrective action plan requirement is triggered, then yes, we expect the agencies to have a corrective action plan and to meet certain benchmarks.
Chair Cleburne, briefly.
Thank you. So the corrective action plan is reactive, not preventative. Have we seen a fiscal note on this bill?
Chair Nash and Co-Chair Cleburne. We did request a fiscal note. It was supposed to be ready for by today, but MMB asked for more time. I look forward to seeing the savings that we will get from this bill.
Chair Cleburne, concluding statement.
Thank you very much. What time is it? There's a glare on the clock. I can't see the clock. Okay. So we have no fiscal note. This bill has no preventative measures. And Representative Niska, before you came to this bill, I level set for the committee the actions that were passed in 2023, 2024 that were actual preventative measures that I believe you yourself voted against, including pre-award risk assessments, more detailed agreements, mandatory reporting, progress reports, investment in oversight, and extensive grant requirements. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would ask our members to vote no on this bill. It's not ready, it's not preventative, and it is actually punitive and harmful to the Minnesotans who are both suffering from fraud, which we all agree should not occur, and it is punitive in that you just unallot their services. So, members, please vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Representative Niska, conclusions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this important bill. Let's be clear. If the answer to this were more resources, if the answer to this problem were the preventative measures that we just heard about, we wouldn't be dealing with this problem. For years, the legislature has given these agencies more and more resources, every possible resource. We gave them internal auditors and compliance leads like the guy who was keying Teslas on the clock. And what did we get? We got a 70-30 culture where compliance is an afterthought. This bill is going to ensure that the next time a program explodes, the agency doesn't get a budget increase to fix it. They get a mandate to prioritize compliance or lose their funding. They get a mandate that we have accountability. Minnesotans demand accountability. Please vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Niska. And with that, Representative Davis renews his motion to send House File 3395 as amended to public safety. The roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nash.
Nash votes aye.
Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, no.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, aye.
Representative Clardy.
Clardy, no.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Jones, excused. Representative Joy.
Yes.
Representative Kosnick.
Yes.
Representative Kraft.
No.
Representative Luger-Nicolai.
No.
Representative Quam.
Yes.
Representative Sexton.
Yes. With a count of 7 ayes and 6 noes, the bill is not advanced to the next committee. And with that, members, we are adjourned.